This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. One of the most anticipated books this fall is the third novel by my guest, Ruman Alam. It's the story of a white middle-class family from Brooklyn enjoying their vacation in a luxurious rented home on a remote bucolic stretch of Long Island when they're unexpectedly visited at night by an older black couple who say they're the owners of the property and have come fleeing a massive power outage in New York. It's a story about race and class relations and how the two families respond to a mysterious set of events that seem to threaten the future of civilization. The book, Leave the World Behind, has been nominated for the National Book Award in Fiction. Ruman Alam is also the author of the novels Rich and Pretty and That Kind of Mother. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Elle, New York Magazine, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and other publications. He also hosts two podcasts on Slate, Working and Outward. He joins us from his home in Brooklyn. Ruman Alam, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this story involves a family of four and an older couple who find themselves in this house in a kind of remote area of Long Island when this mysterious crisis affects them. Can you just tell us a little bit about these characters and what connects them?
Sure. The family is a couple named Amanda and Clay. They have two teenagers, Archie and Rose, and they're a kind of striving upper middle class white family from a nice part of Brooklyn. And they're heading out to Long Island for the kind of holiday that we used to have when we weren't all trying to stay home in service of public health. And they're kind of splurging on an experience of life that is not normally theirs. They're staying in a beautiful house, it's in a beautiful place, and it's theirs for the week.
They've rented it, it's an Airbnb or a rental, right?
They've rented it, it's an Airbnb. And they're anticipating having this kind of private experience as a family, which I think is sort of, you know, the ideal of vacation. And it is interrupted, as you say, by a knock on the door, and it is an older black couple, G.H. and Ruth, and they own the home. They're both upper middle class families. I mean, G.H. and Ruth are wealthier than Amanda and Clay, but there's still a particular kind of collision between their differences. They're different generations, they are different kinds of wealthy, and they are, of course, one couple is white and one couple is black.
Right. And when the white couple who are there thinking they're in this isolated place, it's got a hot tub, it's got a pool, the kids are having a great time, they've had one night, they've had a barbecue, and then this knock on the door, and these people say they're the owners of this place, and then what are the reactions of Clay and Amanda?
Their immediate reaction is disbelief, and the reader is meant to feel a bit of discomfort there because, of course, a knock at the door late at night in a place where you're not expecting to be feels suspicious. It feels threatening. But this liberal white couple is then forced to confront the fact that their immediate presumption is that this black couple who show up on their doorstep must somehow be criminals, that they must be lying, that they couldn't possibly have a house this nice because they are black. Amanda reflects at one point that they look like they could be the handyman and the maid associated with the house, and that maybe this whole thing is just a con. It's an uncomfortable place to be because they're acknowledging some very deep and unflattering preconceptions based on race. At the same time, it is scary. It is nighttime. They're in this place where they ought not to be, and they're not expecting to confront people in the middle of the night on their doorstep.
So when the white couple, Clay and Amanda, are a little suspicious that these people arriving, Ruth and G.H., are really the owners of the house, how do Ruth and G.H. establish that they are?
There's a line in the book where G.H. is standing on the porch and Amanda and Clay are looking at him, and he raises his hands. And the book says that by his age, black men are adept at this gesture, a way of showing that he is unarmed, a way of showing that he comes in peace. This couple understands that even though this is their house, in this particular context, as black people, the power dynamic is what it is. And they understand what they're getting into, what they're negotiating. So I think that Ruth and G.H. come into the book in all honesty, and what they are saying should be taken at face value. But Amanda and Clay do not accept it.
Right. And in some circumstances, the black person might, look, I can show you my driver's license, whatever. In this case, it's we know the house. There are pictures of our family around.
It seems self-evident to them. It seems clear, I think, that they are there because of an emergency and that they are in possession of the facts, that they possess this house. They have a kind of confidence in the world because people, older people in particular, and wealthy older people, I think, have that particular confidence in the world. And it doesn't really carry much traction with Amanda and Clay. And so it's a strange confrontation, but everyone feels a little unstable, I think, in that moment, especially, hopefully, the reader.
It happens that G.H. and Ruth, the couple that have arrived, are indeed the owners of the home. They're quite well off. And they explain that there's been a massive power outage in New York and maybe beyond. And they say, can we stay? There's a mother-in-law apartment on the lower floor. And it's kind of awkward, but that's what happens. And one of the things that's interesting about this book when we consider the current times is that you got people sort of holed up at home, not sure whether to venture out in a world that may have changed or to stay home where it is safe, which is exactly what so many of us are doing right now. Was this just a coincidence?
It's purely coincidence. I could not have foreseen the particular cultural moment into which I'm publishing this book. You know, there's a discomfort in that metaphor of the home, the luxurious home that promises to be this family's getaway, that eventually becomes this family's trap. This moment that sees us trying to stay home in service of public health, I think we've all felt that particular tension. You know, those of us who are fortunate enough to have a home, have a safe place to be, have the kind of work that we can do from our homes, you know, have our health, we understand that it's important to stay home and that it's important to sort of think about the larger community. At the same time, I think we can't help but feel a little trapped. I know I felt really trapped earlier this year when it was March and it was kind of cold outside and the playgrounds weren't open and there really was nowhere for me and my kids to go. And it's hard to hold those two things in your head, that you can have the great fortune of having a place to be and still feel a little trapped there.
You know, race divides us in so many ways. And an interesting question that this poses is, if there is a crisis which threatens us all, which maybe even threatens human civilization, do our prejudices, you know, blossom and drive all of our reactions? Or do we realize that we face a common threat and we really have more in common than we do differences? How do you see that playing in this story?
Oh, it's a very thorny question. I think we want to believe in our own ability to take the high road and say, well, this is an emergency, but we are all in this together. And that runs headlong into a very human, I think, desire to say, I will take care of my family. It's not hard to walk from I will take care of my family to I will take care of my own. And my own can be defined, you know, very broadly. And the particular discomfort that they feel early in the book, upon opening the door and realizing that the person standing outside is Black, lingers. This sense lingers that perhaps because they are of different races, they cannot get to a place of pure understanding. Although I think what ultimately happens challenges some of that.
One of the ways that we feel the tension in this story is that the characters, you know, have no cell phone service, no internet. And they're just used to constantly checking their devices for information and reassurance. Are you addicted to your phone and your devices?
I mean, listen, haven't we all been there? Haven't we all been there? I mean, you feel that phantom ring of your phone in your pocket. You are looking at your phone. You're looking at the New York Times app on your phone. And then you think, oh, where's my phone? I need to check my email. And it's right there in your hand and you're looking right into it. You find yourself making a familiar drive, one that you make all the time, to the grocery store to pick up your kids at school or whatever it is, and you realize that you don't have your GPS and you don't understand where you're going. The phone has had a very profound effect on us. You know, technology has rewired contemporary existence. And I think it's worth thinking about. And in a moment of real crisis, we are all going to look at our phones to be told what to do. And sometimes that information is not forthcoming, and that's very unsettling.
Right. So if some actor were able to shut down the internet, Wow.
It's scary. It's scary to consider. I mean, one of the characters is describing that experience of being on a plane and you hear those dings that tell you you're below 10,000 feet or whatever it is, and everybody starts looking at their phone surreptitiously, hoping to catch on to the cell phone network for the first time and find out what they've missed during the duration of that flight. It's become a very addictive force in this culture.
I'm wondering if you, for the purposes of crafting this story, have a fully blown explanation for everything that's going on.
That's a great question. And the answer is that I do not. This is a book that poses, let's say, 15 questions and answers maybe 7 of them. There's a lot that is unknown in the book and that remains unknowable to me also. Every answer the book offers, oh, this thing has happened, that thing has happened, this thing has happened, you can put them together and they don't really tell you anything. But so much of the point of the book, I think, is that in this contemporary moment, that information does elude us. And once we possess it, we still don't really have the answer we think we do.
Your parents are from Bangladesh. You grew up in an affluent suburb in Washington, D.C., right?
That's right.
And I read you didn't have a lot of contact with relatives in Bangladesh. And was this by design on your parents' part?
No, I think it was just sort of the terms of life. You know, I was born in 1977, and I'm one of 4 children. It would have been very expensive for us to schlep back and forth across the world once a year. It was a big indulgence. We would go back to Bangladesh every 3 or 4 years. When I was a young kid, I got very ill, actually, on one trip to Bangladesh. And so my parents were kind of cautious about taking us to a place where, you know, the climate was so different, the food was so different, it could be difficult on a young kid's system. And this was also just a different moment in this country. And my parents arrived in this country in the early 1970s with the intention of becoming wholly American. They were here to pursue higher degrees, and they raised us in a way that was really quite American. And in some ways, I guess they had no choice, because once you send your kid off to school in this country, that is just who they become. And so I'm mindful of that particular tension for every immigrant who comes to this country, that you come to provide something for your children. You have to watch your children become something that you yourself are not. And so you inhabit this strange interstitial space. And in fact, your children do as well, where your children are not quite of America and not quite of the place from which you've come. It's a complicated negotiation. And I think that the culture now values immigrant communities in a different way. I think that there's a sense that immigrant communities can retain a sense of their own identity, and that is not, you know, suspect, or that is not difficult to do. For whatever reason, because of our geography, because of my parents' own personal choices that I don't have access to because I was a child then, that wasn't my experience. We were not raised with a strong sense of our own culture. I don't know the language. As a young kid, I kind of rejected the food, which is insane to me now because nothing is more delicious than the food from that part of the world. But, you know, that is just how I was. I was a kid who wanted to eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and watch cartoons. And that's just who I was. And that sort of created I inhabit a strange place where I might look like I'm from another place, but I really feel a product of this country.
Right. When you were growing up, did you feel accepted by classmates, friends, teachers?
I did. I didn't have a particular awareness of myself as other. And that is an awareness that I still don't really possess, because you don't walk around in your body conscious of the ways in which you are different. You walk around in your body as yourself. And it wasn't until my adulthood, really, that I began to see the ways in which maybe I wasn't accessing an experience of the world that my white peers were. And that's destabilizing and strange, and it's strange to think about even now that I was able to delude myself for as long as I was, or that I was unclear about exactly who I was for so long.
Yeah. Was assimilation a conscious goal of your parents, do you think?
I'm not sure if it was a conscious goal. I think that that was the value, to come to this country and, you know, we talk about the American dream, right? To master the American dream, to possess that. And they certainly did. My parents came to this country with very little. They were both graduate students, essentially. And by the time Ronald Reagan was the president, they were quite wealthy and quite successful, and they had 4 children, and we all went off to great schools, and we are the American dream in many ways. It's just maybe that American dream, the terms of it have changed a little.
You are gay, you're married, your husband in Brooklyn, you have 2 kids. And I'm wondering if you're comfortable talking about it, when, you know, you were clear about your sexual orientation and how that affected your sense of identity.
That's another strange psychic split, right? Where you can be conscious of something from a very early age and not articulate it to yourself until much later. That's a phenomenon of the closet, right? And I do think that that's changing as we have a different cultural understanding of what it is to be gay. There's more acceptance of that. But I certainly knew from a very early age that I felt different about, you know, having a crush on a boy on television. Like, I was conscious of that, but I was also conscious of never acknowledging that aloud. And it's hard for me to say what effect that has had on my adulthood or my sort of psyche. It just is the way it is. And I think that's really changing. There will still be children who experience that, but there will also be children who don't. There will be children who never know what it is like to sublimate their own sense of self.
You went to Oberlin and studied creative writing. It's interesting, you know, as I've read about you, it sounds like for much of your career, you know, you developed your craft and your voice, and then people expected you to be a different kind of writer. They wanted you to represent, you know, your ethnic background. Did that go way back?
I think that is a particular burden that so many artists bear, that if you are gay, you are a gay artist, that if you are Black, you are a Black artist, that if you are Latinx, you are a Latinx artist, and that your work must engage with probing that particular identity. It is possible to be a Black artist who does not write about Blackness, or it is possible to be a Black artist who does not write about Blackness exclusively. But I do think that when you talk about the cultural industry, as opposed to artistic expression, writers and artists need to be filed by type. They need to be understood as a certain kind of thing. And so there's an expectation sometimes that if you are an Indian artist, you are writing of the Indian experience. If you're a Bengali artist, as I am, you're writing of the Bengali experience. I don't think I'm doing that in my work, or I think I've resisted doing that in my work. And that creates a strange break in the system. It's as though I've declined to honor this particular obligation. And I'm not sure I meant to act out in this particular way, but here I am. I have written 3 books now, and none of them have talked about who I am as a person.
Your second novel, That Kind of Mother, is about a white woman who has she's a nursing coach, has a relationship with this woman, who then becomes her nanny and who is African-American. The nanny then dies, and then the woman adopts 2 Black children, which you have done, right? I guess
the nanny dies in childbirth and she adopts the baby, yeah.
Right. You're the adopted parent of 2 Black children. Was that long before you had, where did that book come in relationship to your own 2 adoptions?
Oh, no. Yes, I wrote that book after I had become a parent. And those are not the circumstances in which I became a parent. But that book distills many of my own experiences as a parent and many of the feelings I have had as a parent. And there's a natural, I think, tendency for readers to look for autobiography in fiction. And the truth is that my work, especially that work, is quite autobiographical, because in a way that's all I know, right? You're always hostage to your own autobiography. You can only see things through the lens of your own lived experience. It's just very hard for people to see, by the simple choice to choose to write about a woman as opposed to a man. The notion that I'm writing about motherhood instead of fatherhood clouds the territory a little bit. But that is very much a book about my own feelings about being a father.
I'm wondering what you do when you are not writing novels. I mean, you write reviews, right?
I do. It's a way of staying engaged in the literature, but not thinking about my own work, thinking about the work of writers who are better than me, writers like Zadie Smith or Ben Lerner or Ellie Smith. And it's a great, great exercise. I think it really keeps me sharp. I'm also teaching this semester, And as so many parents are, I'm also helping my children negotiate homeschool. So I'm kind of a teacher for sixth grade and the third grade as well. I think it's very important for me to have other pursuits beyond my own fiction, to have a thing that I can do that enriches my understanding of the world that isn't just about my own sort of invented worlds. I really enjoy writing about books. I also sometimes write about music or film. It's really helpful to me. I think what I say when I teach writing is that writing is an input-output proposition. And it's very difficult to get to the point of output if you haven't had any input. And so a tether or a perspective on what's happening in the world that has to do with other people's work is really useful for me.
Well, Ruwan Alam, it's congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Ruwan Alam's third novel is Leave the World Behind. There's a new version of one of Prince's most highly praised releases, Sign of the Times. What's billed as the Super Deluxe Edition is a package containing 8 CDs, including 3 discs of previously unreleased material, plus a concert performance DVD. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed the album for Fresh Air at its original release in 1987. Now, 33 years later, he's given the expanded version a fresh spin, and he finds Prince's creativity more impressive than ever.
It was 7:45 on the line to bring to teacher Miss Kathleen. First was Kevin, then came Lucy, third in line was me. All of us were ordinary compared to Cynthia Rose. She always stood at the back of the line, a smile beneath her nose. Her favorite number was 20, and every single day. If you ask her what you had for breakfast, this is what she'd say. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds and a tangerine, the side on a ham. If you set your mind free, baby, maybe you understand. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam.
In this age of everything is overrated, I try to avoid using the word masterpiece. But in 1987, Prince released Sign of the Times, and 33 years later, it really does hold up as his masterpiece. The sustained excellence of its double album length, edging out what will always be my favorite Prince album, 1980's Dirty Mind. Sign of the Times was meant to be a triple album, but Prince's label Warner Brothers thought that was economically unwise and pressured him to reduce it to a double. That must have pained Prince mightily, because this was an especially ripe period for him. His ideas and work ethic seemed limitless. Just how limitless is suggested by this new so-called Super Deluxe version of Sign of the Times, containing 8 music discs, 3 of which are previously unreleased songs. That's a tune called Eggplant. There's an impressive range of music on these discs. In my original 1987 review here on Fresh Air, I noted that the music gives the lie to the idea that black artists are only influenced by other black artists. There's also a wide range of moods and characters created and inhabited by the lyrics. At one point during this era, Prince had planned to put out an album under the pseudonym of Camille, singing from a female point of view. One example of this is the song Jealous Girl. Unlike most expanded editions of albums by other artists, this one contains a lot of first-mate material that could easily have been included on Sign of the Times. Even Prince's rejects, such as the instantly addictive Promise to Be True, sound like hit singles.
Well, hello. It's about time you got home. No, baby, don't try that tail wagging routine on me. I want to know where you been. Now speak. That's right. Get to talking. I'll get to walking.
The album also contains some music that will be familiar to anyone who went to Prince concerts. We finally get the formal release of the superb funk groove called Soul Psychedelicide, a concert staple that many of us remember Prince used to cue his band to play by yelling the words, "Ice cream!" To put this material in some context, in 1986, Prince had two breakups. He disbanded his backup group, The Revolution, and in his personal life, he broke off an engagement. The majority of the music on this huge collection is the work of Prince as a one-man band, a solitary artist creating a crowd of sounds as company. He was at once at the height of his powers and in a period of transition, which resulted in relentless quests to seek out new sounds, new goals, new areas of exploration. It inspired, for example, this swirling maelstrom of hard rock and romanticism called Love and Sex.
Love and sex, an emotional merry-go-round. It's like running a race wheel upside down. Every time I see her, my heart just pounds and my legs go weak. It's hard to speak. All I can say is I'm under your ass. All I wanna do is you love and sex. Check me out.
The sheer playfulness and generosity of so many of these songs, the life that bursts from this cascade of music, makes Prince's death in 2016 seem once again such a staggering loss.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed the new Super Deluxe edition of Prince's 1987 album, Sign of the Times. There's a new film which documents an unusual but touching friendship. Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger talked to the filmmaker. I'll let Sam take it from here.
One of the most heartening films of the year is about the relationship between our guest, filmmaker Craig Foster, and an octopus he befriends while diving off the Western Cape of South Africa. Foster had been burned out from years of working on arduous nature films and decided he needed a reset. Craig Foster vowed that he would dive without a wetsuit or oxygen tank every day for a year into the chilly waters near where he grew up to explore the kelp forest, an ecosystem teeming with life. It was there that he gained the trust of an octopus who allowed him into its world, where Foster discovered things about its life and his own. Foster's film is called My Octopus Teacher, and it's available on Netflix. He also has a book about his exploration of the kelp forest called Sea Change. Foster's received over 60 international awards for his work in documentary films. I spoke to him from his home in Cape Town. Craig Foster, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be here.
So this journey began when you started diving in the waters of the Western Cape, near where you grew up, every day for a year. What compelled you to do that?
Well, I just, you know, I'd been through a very, very busy time. I felt tired, lacking drive. I was burnt out. And my earliest memories, my deepest and most powerful memories, were of this incredible coast and diving in what I call my magical childhood forest, the Great African Sea Forest, this underwater forest. So it was a natural place for me to go, just to keep going into that water every day. And as I did that day after day, I slowly started to get my energy back and realized that there was this, you know, whole new way of looking at this underwater forest. And I started to come alive again.
And these are cold waters. It sounds like they can get to 46 degrees Fahrenheit. But you decided to dive without a wetsuit and without an oxygen tank. Why is that?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people initially said, you know, why are you diving without a wetsuit? It's crazy. And over the years, I've taken many people into the water to show them what it's like to skin dive, to free dive without, with a minimal equipment. And Sam, what it does is, first of all, the cold actually changes the chemical nature in your brain. It pushes a whole lot of feel-good chemicals into the brain. So you feel alive, you feel awake, you feel stimulated. But because you can feel that water on your skin, you can feel the slight temperature differences, you feel much closer to nature. You feel more amphibious in a way. I like to ponder on the amphibious nature of our humanness. And diving in this way, with this method, brings out that amphibious nature. So they're actually quite a lot of advantages to it. And what it does in the long run is this cold stress actually puts a certain stress on the immune system that makes it quite a lot stronger. So you get much healthier during that process.
Let's talk about the octopus. So one day you're diving in the kelp forest and you see this strange collection, like it's like a ball of shells and rocks, and you realize there's an octopus in there because the octopus swims away at some point. And it's been holding all the shells and rocks against its body, covering itself. And it sounds like this behavior had not been documented before. What have you learned about this behavior?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I call this behavior armoring. And what I've learned is that octopus, you know, they've got all sorts of ways of dealing with predators. And of course, you'd have known about the inking, you know about the whole camouflage and everything. But one of the last resorts that they do, if they're in the right kind of environment, they will suddenly very, very quickly pick up up to 70 shells and stones and sometimes even bits of algae and cover their whole body with them by turning their arms over their head, because the head is the very sensitive part of an octopus's anatomy. And if a predator bites or interferes with the head, there's often a really big problem. So with the suckers, they pick up all these pieces and then in a very short space of time, in the seconds, they cover themselves and they're suddenly armored. And this is in evolutionary perspective, this animal has discarded its shell to become more of a liquid creature. So there's a lot of advantages to being a liquid creature. And then in this incredible way has figured out a way to quickly create this temporary shell, hard shell, that can deter a predator.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think, you know, during your time in the kelp forest, you're just fascinated by this creature. And so you start visiting it every day and you actually gain its trust and it becomes comfortable following you around and it lets you follow it around and it would even attach to you and swim with you. Had you ever had an interaction like this with a wild creature before?
Not anywhere at this level. Because I've been diving for years. I've been diving since I was 3 years old. I'm now 52. And in the last 9 years, I've dived every single day as a commitment to understanding the ocean. So I have had fascinating encounters with various animals, animals that have decided to come and make contact with me. But it's mostly fleeting. You know, it happens just on one occasion, on one day, and it's kind of mysterious and it's interesting. But this was different in that, you know, this was over a long period of time that this trust and this this physical contact built up. Sometimes when she'd eaten or when she was, you know, they're quite moody. Sometimes she didn't want to have contact. So it wasn't like it was happening absolutely every day, but certainly I had many extraordinary experiences with her, and many, many times I couldn't, you know, film them as well. So, you know, the film is just a slice, really, of the experience of being with this incredible creature and learning from her.
So you're fascinated by this octopus, and you decide that you're going to go visit it every day and observe it. And at one point, the octopus actually reaches out and touches you. What did that moment feel like?
You know, that's obviously a special moment when that animal decides to make that first contact. And, you know, other octopus have done that to me as well. But it was somehow different with her. It's impossible to explain. But you must realize, Sam, she's still holding on with all her arms. It's just that one arm that she's sending out. The real moment when I was like just completely blown away was when she came out the den right in front of me. And then there's no arms holding back. That's when I realized this animal trusts me. She no longer sees me as a threat, and her fear changes to curiosity. That's the big moment. The really rare and special thing is when the trust forms, and that is a totally different scenario when that animal comes out and there's no, its whole body is vulnerable, and she goes about hunting and doing her incredible behaviors. That's when the real excitement comes, and you think, oh my goodness, I'm being let into the secret world of this wild animal, and that's when you feel on fire.
So when the octopus touches you, what do the suckers feel like?
You'd be surprised how incredibly powerful the suction is. And they are covered in a kind of octopus slime that makes it even adhere more strongly. But they are very, very strong. I mean, if you try and pull directly back when that animal is holding you, it's really very, very difficult, and you'd have to force it. So you have to gently twist and turn if you need to go up to have a breath of air, because you don't want to pull too hard on that animal. So you have to kind of curl and twist to break that incredibly powerful suction.
Well, is it easy, or is it a trap to start anthropomorphizing a creature like this when you're trying to understand its behavior?
I think you have to be very careful of that, because she's, you know, she's 200 million years away from us on the evolutionary scale. So in some ways, she's this very ancient mind, but her neural makeup is in some ways similar to ours. So there is a possibility that she could feel certain emotions, but how those are interpreted. And also what's very interesting, Sam, is that 2/3 of her cognition is outside of her brain, in her arms. And so her arms have this external cognition. And now, you know, it's so hard for us to get our thoughts around how that all works. So you're dealing with a very different creature in many ways, but perhaps the underlying nature of cognition is not that dissimilar. That's also in the back of one's mind. So it's mysterious. And that's what makes it so interesting. And that's why I will study these animals for the rest of my life and only know a tiny bit of how they work.
So, you know, the common octopus has a pretty short lifespan of about a year. And you had, you know, you figured out you'd been spending a lot of time with this octopus and clearly her lifespan was coming to an end. Did you start to feel ambivalent about your trips to the ocean during those last days? Like, were you looking forward to seeing her, but also dreading the end?
Yeah, it was obviously difficult. You know, you get close to an animal like this. I was certainly dreading that. But at the same time, I mean, I guess in some ways it's better than a human death, because it's quite merciful, it's quite short, and also what happens when she gets to the end of her life, she becomes senescent, senile, so her brain starts to not work so well, so she's not fully aware of what's going on, and that brought some comfort.
Hmm. So we see the octopus mate, and a male octopus comes along, and it's at first just sitting near her, and then it looks like one of its arms is extending out to her. What's mating like for an octopus? It looked pretty transactional.
Yes, I mean, it can be very dangerous. Sometimes the, you know, especially if the female is bigger, she can even kill the male after mating. So sometimes he's very cautious. And that's why he's like extending the arm right out, like there's this tiny little penis on the end of the arm. And so they're very antisocial animals. So it's not some great love affair, that's for sure.
And does this process signal the end of the life cycle for both the male and the female?
Correct. So the male also starts to deteriorate quite quickly after the mating. It's called, I think the word is semilparous, and many animals, especially insects, have the same process.
So the octopus hatches her babies, and at this point, she's sort of been holding on to her life energy to sort of get to that point, and then she's sort of at the end of her life, and her energy's gone, and her body washes out of her den. And there's this incredibly beautiful but sad image that you have of her laying on the seafloor, and her eyes are closed, and she's gotten really pale. You say she can no longer sort of change the color of her skin, and like her body swaying a little bit with the movement of the water. It's an incredibly moving shot. I was just wondering what you felt taking that shot.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's, you know, most difficult, very, very difficult, and it's hard to sort of express it without getting a bit emotional. I almost try to not to think of that too much, because it makes me feel sad. Difficult. Yeah, really difficult.
In the movie, you say that you still visit her den after her death, and you would sort of float above it and feel her presence. Do you still do that? Do you visit her den?
Funny enough, Sam, I went to her. You know, she had a few dens, but her main den, where she spent the most of the time, I went to visit that den today. This morning, it's just a great feeling, you know, to go there and, I just dive down and kind of silently thank her for this incredible teaching that she's given me. And what's so interesting is that, I've seen there was nothing. What happens is once she moves out of the den, it soon fills up completely with sand. So it's basically just a rock edge. But what's so interesting is that other octopuses seem to be able to somehow sense exactly where she's denned, and they have made a den in exactly that same place. And I've seen this at other den sites as well. So there's something, maybe they can smell, there's some incredible ability to smell, because then they have to, of course, excavate and dig the whole den out. There's no sign of it having been there. I'm sure in a few weeks or a month I'll find another octopus in that same, exactly that same place. And it's not, 20 or 30 centimeters away. It's in the same place.
Craig Foster, thanks so much for coming on Fresh Air.
It's been a great pleasure, Sam, speaking to you, and I really appreciate it.
Craig Foster's film is My Octopus Teacher. It can be seen on Netflix. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.